You've reached the Every Little Thing helpline. Please leave your message after the tone.
Hi there. My question has to do with how wildfires or really any fire started, like how the fire detectives know if like a cigarette butt or a firework started these massive fires.
Hello?
Hey, Sidera, it's Flora from ELT.
Hey, Flora, how are you today?
I'm good. So are you living in a fire zone right now?
So I just moved out of Idaho into Wyoming, and there are some big ones brewing in the area, but this year I've actually been more distant than years previous.
Have you had close encounters before?
Yeah, so I think I was a 10th grader. And so we knew the fire, where it was and where it was going, but then the winds shifted and it ended up coming towards the town. And it was so smoky. I think that thick smoke just creates this eerie feeling. The sun gets this really weird, glowy orange color. The apocalyptic feel is so real.
What prompted you to call us with this burning question?
I was on a drive with my partner, my significant other. We were driving back to Boise through the Stanley, Idaho area. It's a pretty mountainous area, very rural, but a lot of trees around. And we saw a pretty large burned area. The tree trunks still stood and they were blackened, but they didn't have any arms or branches or anything. And then we just got on the topic of how do people know how fires are started? I just have no idea how you get from a massive fire in the wilderness to it was caused from a cigarette butt.
We found just the person to extinguish your curiosity.
Stoked.
Okay, Paul Steensland, and I am a semi-retired wildland fire investigator.
Cool title.
So Paul specializes in wildfires.
Okay.
And he's kind of seen it all. He's investigated a lot of fires.
At least in the neighborhood of 700 plus.
Oh my gosh.
And that's over a course of 50, you know, close to 50 years.
I think in the court of Every Little Thing, you are officially an expert witness.
Thank you. I've been qualified by both federal and state courts in that.
Oh, dang.
So Paul's job is to determine the cause of a wildfire. So he's part scientist, part detective. And he says the job can be intense.
It has its moments.
He interviews witnesses, sometimes people who've lost a lot. He confronts suspects.
Oh my gosh.
And if he finds someone is at fault, he may testify in court. And for wildfires, usually there is someone at fault.
No way. I thought lightning strikes would cause way more than people.
Common misconception, Paul says. Although a bizarre barrage of lightning sparked hundreds of fires in California this year, in general, in the western U.S.,
lightning counts for maybe 12 to 15% of fires per year, and 80-plus percent are all human-caused.
Whoa.
And if you factor in climate change turning the West into an arid tinderbox, you could attribute even more fires to people's actions.
How do you get into this very specific form of firefighting?
Paul's interest in fire has been smoldering since he was a kid. And he told us about one particularly memorable incident.
You know what a match gun is?
I don't know what a match gun is.
Okay, it's you construct it out of like scrap wood with a, I probably shouldn't give the design details. We don't want a whole bunch of budding arsonists running out there using this. But when you pull the trigger on it, the rubber band, you know, pushes the match through and it hits a piece of sandpaper and it ignites. And we were shooting each other with these match guns. So it was great fun. You know, a bunch of kids with these running around, you know, late summer, early fall day.
How old were you?
I had to have been at least 10. And it was just cold enough. I was wearing a mohair sweater, which in those days was probably made out of some petroleum byproduct and was, come to find out, was highly flammable. And Jerry Brown shot me in the back with a match and it caught my sweater on fire. So, you know, what do you do when you catch on fire? You know, you panic.
Oh, gosh.
And so I managed to get the sweater off, but where I threw it was into a dry, grassy field. And away it went. And of course, you know, we did like all young criminals do. We fled and hid. and watched the fire department come. And it was just a vacant lot, so it was no big deal. Nothing was, you know, in any real danger. But it scared me enough that I said, yeah, I better find a different way to, you know, play. That does not involve fire.
Did you get in trouble?
No, because nobody knew about it. We all swore a blood oath that we weren't going to tell anybody else about it.
What a great story for a fire investigator.
If you scratch most fire investigators, you'll find something similar, I think, below the surface.
What a direct way to get involved in your future career.
By committing the crime?
Yes, by being the cause.
Paul says this close call snuffed out any desire to start fires. And instead, he became interested in putting them out.
When I was 16 years old, I saw a Richard Widmark movie called The Red Skies of Montana about smoke jumpers. And I said, boy, that looks like the life for me. You know, live out in the woods in a log cabin every now and then, get on an airplane, jump out in a parachute, go fight fire, come home and drink beer the rest of the night.
Dream job.
Yeah.
Smoke jumping, to me, I think would be terrifying. So I'm really glad people have that adrenaline rush to want to do that.
So Paul wanted to, but when he went to apply for the smoke jumper job,
I was told, no, you're too young, A, and two, you don't have enough experience. And so I said, okay. So I went to work for Cal Fire as a, you know, basic level firefighter, and Cal Fire being the California Fire Service for the state. So the second year that I was working for Cal Fire, a guy took me under his wing and started mentoring me.
And that mentor changed his course. He taught Paul about fire investigation, and Paul loved it.
You know, I just found it fascinating. I like puzzles. You know, I just go like, how in the heck do you take this 1,000, 10,000, million acre fire and get it down to that one square inch area where the fire actually started?
Yeah, that is the burning question.
And you're going to get an answer to it after the break. How do you take a million-acre fire and narrow it down to the square inch where it started? Any guesses how they do this?
I have no idea unless a person admits to what they have done.
Okay, so here's how it works. Paul says that once someone reports a fire, in general, the Forest Service or the State Department of Forestry assigns a fire investigator who heads to the scene. And Paul says he's worked fires months after the fire was put out, but ideally the investigator gets there within hours or maybe a day or two of the fire starting.
So the fire could or could not be put out yet.
Yeah. In fact, sometimes the fire is still burning when they get there.
Oh, man.
If there's active fire, we'll be out there in, you know, hard hat and heavy, you know, firefighting boots. You know, they're at least 8 inches high, if not 10 inches. And so, yeah, it's pretty clunky.
Suited up.
And it gets even clunkier. Picture Paul, like, in this heavy outfit. And then on top of that, he's lugging around a giant plastic case.
I have two big, I think the biggest they make, Pelican cases, full of all the tools I carry.
Some must-haves for Paul. A pencil and paper, a tape measure, and a camera. Over the course of the investigation, Paul will take a couple hundred photographs for the report he draws up at the end.
Just the best way to communicate your findings to whoever's interested in what caused the fire or, you know, may have caused the fire.
He's making more fuel for his case?
I'll take it.
Okay, thanks.
So he gets to work, and his top priority is finding the spot where the fire began.
Because you can't determine cause unless you know approximately where the fire started.
Say the fire's 10,000 acres. Paul can use the initial reports from witnesses and the people who called in the fire to get a general idea of where the fire started.
That's going to help me narrow that 10,000 acres down to a relatively much, much smaller area. Acre at the most, half acre is what I shoot for.
An acre or half acre still seems huge to me.
It is huge, which is why after Paul maps out the half acre, he has to start sifting through the clues to narrow it down to an even smaller area.
We're going to, at this point, now start looking at physical indicators on the ground. You know, burnt grass stem heads or an individual pebble might have an indicator on it.
Paul's looking for indications of which way the fire was moving within that half acre, which way the fire is advancing.
Okay.
One that I like to use a lot is called angle of char.
Definition, please.
It's the direction of the burn mark. So picture a tree.
Okay.
If you're looking at that tree and you see a burn mark that goes diagonally up the trunk of the tree, like it's low on the left, higher on the right.
Okay.
That suggests the fire was moving from left to right.
The principle behind that is on like any kind of standing tree or brush that's, you know, typically at least 6 feet high or more. The fire, the advancing fire, will come in low, but because of the way fire burns, it goes out high, leaving a very distinct angle of what's been burned and what's been not burned.
Okay, that makes sense.
The other big indicator Paul looks for is called foliage freeze.
Foliage is plants, freeze, I don't put in the context of fire.
Okay, so let's just use like a very common specimen is pine. Pine needles are really great indicators of foliage freeze. So what happens is as that fire moves through that particular tree, the needles become soft and pliant and flexible because they've been heated up. And so the wind will push those needles in the direction that the wind is blowing. And as that fire goes by, it dries them out. The heat dries them out. And they remain frozen in that position.
The pine needles are basically pointing in the direction the wind was blowing.
How cool. I would never think of that. That's awesome.
And fire often follows the wind.
So you combine foliage freeze with angle of char, and you've got really good indicators that, yes, this was an advancing fire and is going that away.
Okay. There are little breadcrumbs.
Exactly. So picture Paul pacing back and forth across this half acre, reading leaves and rocks and tree trunks, and using them, just like you said, like little breadcrumbs, pointing to the spot where the fire started.
Okay.
Paul says that using these clues, he can narrow that fire's origin point to a few feet or even a few inches.
Holy cow.
Then it's time to stop and drop.
You need to be down at your nose in the ash, basically.
I can picture him crawling.
So at this point, Paul breaks out another badass fire investigator tool.
I like to use like three and a half power reading glasses because then you don't have, both your hands are free. Plus it gives you a very professorial air, you know, astuteness when they're perched on the end of your nose like that.
Paul needs magnification because at this point he's ready to start looking for the thing that sparked the blaze. And there are some usual suspects depending on where you are.
Typically on the West Coast, equipment use is probably your number one from year to year.
Like, think about the saws that are used to harvest timber.
That saw head has metal teeth on it that are rotating pretty fast when it's running at full speed. And so if that operator is a little bit careless or a little bit inexperienced, they might contact a rock with that saw head and it'll shave off metal fragments and they're red hot and away you go.
So anything that sparks or causes heat.
Yeah, exactly. Bulldozer treads, chainsaws, engines, they can all give off burning hot particles that can smolder in dry vegetation.
Interesting.
So that means Paul is often looking for tiny scraps of metal, like sometimes too tiny even for 3x magnification reading glasses.
Yeah, what do you use next?
He's got to break out the magnet and the metal detector.
I use both.
And now picture him having like four arms holding everything, sweeping across this 1 foot square area.
Yeah, it's very Inspector Gadget.
Absolutely.
But his system also works.
I've been successful at detecting a piece of metal about the length of half of a staple.
Oh my goodness, that's tiny.
Then he can send that shard to a lab for analysis to help figure out what it came from.
So the metal ones make sense, but I feel like there's still the cigarette butts, there's still the runaway fire pits.
Can he find evidence of flammable fire starters?
Yes.
The answer is yes. Even in those cases, there's often something left behind. And here's why.
When these fires start, they start very small, typically, with very, very low intensity burning. So it's just the opposite of a structure fire. You know, where the fire starts in a structure, that's where the fire burns the longest. So that's where you see the most damage and the most intense fire typically. In a wildfire, it's the exact opposite. It's the area of least intense burning most of the time. And so therefore, you know, these, what you would say, oh, that's got to be gone. And then there's no way that's going to survive that raging forest fire. But in fact, it will. And the remains of the cigarette will be there many, many times.
I was going to ask about that because I feel like cigarette butts are like the quintessential Smokey Bear commercial for like, you're going to start a fire with your cigarette. Are they actually like the number one fire starter?
And that's just simply not so. For a cigarette to cause a fire, the environmental conditions have to be just in complete alignment. And out of the 700 plus fires that I've done, I can say with pretty good confidence that, let me see, I'm going to give you a ballpark of 10, less than 10 that I was absolutely confident were started by a carelessly discarded cigarette.
Less than 10? Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to, you know, talk about this because I don't want to give people a nod of permission to go ahead and start throwing your cigarette out your window.
So just don't do it because you don't want to be number 11.
Yeah.
A more common way of starting a fire is with matches. And Paul said even those he's been able to find.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. One of my best finds was about, maybe a quarter of a paper match, the head and about a quarter of the stem of a paper match.
The head was still on the match, the burning part.
Yeah, the thing that's literally engineered to go up in flames.
It's like the fire is this big, mighty, destructive thing, except for the things that cause it. So how do we move forward with finding the culprit, I guess?
That's part of Paul's job, too. After he found that smoking matchhead, he had to find the person who struck it.
In that particular case, a bunch of these kids were playing with matches. And I figured that out pretty fast because I found a bunch of burned dolls in the specific origin area, like I think two or three burned Barbie dolls. And so I find, you know, the house was really close nearby. And I found some of the kids that were playing with this other kid. And they all snitched him off immediately.
I definitely have siblings that would have ratted me out that quick as well, so. But that just seems all too easy.
Yeah, Paul said it's not always that way. He doesn't always find the cause, let alone the culprit.
If you can identify a very precise ignition area that's pretty small on, say, 3/4 of the fires you go to, you're doing pretty good. You know, you're up there in the elite category. And out of those, 75% of the times you specifically identify an origin, if you can determine a cause on, say, half or more of those, or even 3/4 of those, then yeah, you're doing really good. Because there's some fires you just don't know. And you never will know.
What do you think, Sidera? Did we put out all your burning questions?
Yeah, now I can do my own fire investigating.
Next time you drive past that patch of burnt wildland, what will you look for?
It depends on how much time I have, because you bet I'm going to be out there looking for that, the freeze of the pine needles.
The foliage freeze.
The foliage freeze. I will be out there on my, maybe I'll go ahead and invest in a good metal detector as well.
At least the reading glasses.
Oh, for sure.
If you have a question you cannot get to the bottom of, give us a call. 833-RING-ELT. 833-RING-ELT.
Every Little Thing is produced by Stephanie Werner, Phoebe Flanagan, Annette Heist, and Flora Lichtman, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Our consulting editors are Caitlin Kenny and Jorge Just. Scored by Bobby Lord, So Wiley, and Dara Hirsch. Mixed by Dara Hirsch. ELT is a Spotify original podcast. Goodbye.